The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Before the podcast begins, I would like to share with you some exciting news. Louis has released a knockout second title, Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring. Round 2 from the amazing life and times of legendary South Florida attorney Louis Ress takes readers from Brooklyn in the 1940s via a spell in a top-secret Army department and a transatlantic solo flight in a replica Spirit of St. Louis to adventures in and out of the courtroom in a sometimes rougher-than-ready 50s and 60s Miami. The book is available now on Amazon. Just search Louis Ress. And before we start, don't forget to like our Facebook page, Miami Memoirs. And now let's begin.
Hi everyone, welcome to Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Ress. Today we'll be doing episode 31, Position of the Lion. Louis, what's the title to the next subject? What's that got have to do with everything?
That's a good question. It's just a strange title.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it a strange title? It's a strange case.
Okay.
And
let's hear it.
It wound up with some crazy testimony by an expert about the position of the lion.
Okay.
And it turned the whole trial around. The issue and the words, the position of the lion, got the jury's attention.
Oh, okay.
And the whole trial turned around. So that's what it's about. It's about a lady named Ann DeAngelo. She was an older woman, she was just like a nun. I knew this because I had been representing the Diocese of Miami for about 5 years at the time. Anyhow, this mild, quiet, thin, 55-year-old, single, graying lady who wore black dresses, long black stockings, black shoes with low heels, tied her hair back with a black ribbon, and wore black rimmed glasses, had been in an automobile accident, and had been recommended to me by her local priest. It was hard to get any information out of her. She spoke softly and hesitatingly, and she said, I am in some pain in my low back, but I am doing well, and I am back to work. Please see if you can settle my case. So did I describe her?
Is that common?
She was all thin.
Yeah, and then even the way she approached you and what she said, it was very, you know, I feel bad for the woman. Like
that's her life.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of nuns that are that way, thin and very aesthetic, very quiet. And that's how she was.
Very poised, it seems, too. Is it common to tell an attorney to settle a case?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it's quite common. And most people want their cases settled. And if you listen today on television, when the lawyers advertise, which they do all the time, one will say, we're not settlement lawyers. We're not negotiators. We'll try your case. If they don't give you a reasonable offer, we'll try your case. Most attorneys accept the offer made by the insurance company and close the file. We don't. We go for more money and we press them and we try the case. Well, most clients don't want to go through a trial. And I'm going to talk to you about the mystique of a trial and why they don't want to go through it. And
of course,
it's rolling dice. So that's one of the reasons that 95% of all cases get settled.
95?
Yes.
That's
I thought it was maybe 90, but it's actually 97.
Huh.
So that's from the statistics. So I tried to settle the case, but in DeAngelo's case, the insurance company's attorney wasn't going to recommend one penny to settle. His name was Joe Stanton. He became a federal judge, and he was a partner in the Sams firm. That's Murray Sams, a very famous plaintiff's lawyer in Miami. And Murray was the most competent, aggressive lawyer in town. And Joe Stanton was in the same group. When a plaintiff's lawyer gets a defense case, watch out. They go wild. They are tougher, harder, and meaner by far than the regular defense boys. They give nothing. They love the idea of appearing in court for the other side.
So then what happened with this guy?
Well, the case had been around for a while, and it was coming up for trial.
Mm-hmm.
Here are the facts. The defendant, Fred Wilson, was an older man, and he was on his way home from the gas station when he entered the intersection. He said that he stopped at the stop sign and started across the street when my client, D'Angelo, mm-hmm. driving an old Ford, struck his car.
Oh.
He had looked to the right up the entire street before entering the intersection, and he saw her coming. But he had more than enough time to cross the road, in his opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, she actually put on speed and crashed into me. It was all her fault.
Huh, that sounds a little twisted, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but and it probably was. But people see things from their own point of view in a way that benefits them, and I'll tell you more about that,
mm-hmm.
about objectively looking at things.
Yep.
Anyhow, Mr. Wilson said that although he did not get out of his car, he saw Mrs. D'Angelo at the scene of the accident and that she was not injured.
Hmm.
And he said, I was the one who was hurt. My arthritis kicked up terribly, and I was treated for my neck and back for over a month.
Oh, boy. How would Mr. Wilson know if Miss D'Angelo was injured? It sounds a little strange, doesn't it?
It sounds fishy as right. how could he know? He was sitting in his car.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a doctor.
Yeah.
She got out of the car and spoke to the police. I guess he was saying that she was able to get out of the car and walk around.
I see.
Of course, Mrs. D'Angelo had quite a different story. She said that she was driving home from church and that Mr. Wilson's brown Pontiac pulled out right in front of her. He had a stop sign that he didn't acknowledge. He never stopped or even slowed down at that stop sign. She had back pain right then and there and complained to the police about it, but she never went to the hospital. 3 days later, the same priest who had recommended me sent her to Dr. Ortiz.
Who is Dr. Ortiz?
Arturo Ortiz. Arturo Ortiz is a great guy. He was the one that said, we ought to win this one, Lewis, when he injected the lady with the placebo, with the sterile water in her back. And she had all these complaints went away when he injected the sterile
mm-hmm.
water.
Yeah, he's
a character. Really nice guy. Extremely conservative physician.
Mm-hmm.
So he was mostly defense-oriented. He was an orthopedic surgeon. He was short, partially bald, with eyeglasses. A really pleasant, refined, fairly low-keyed and well-respected doctor. And he had treated Mrs. D'Angelo for over 6 months with physical therapy for a low back sprain with pain going down her right leg. The medical bill was over $2,000 with x-rays, injections to the low back, heat therapy, and massage. He had not prepared a final report, and that was good for me.
Good, okay.
Because he was going to say there was nothing wrong, that he cured her.
Oh.
When I spoke to Dr. Ortiz, and I'll tell you more about the burden of proof, you have to show a permanent injury in order to get to court.
Okay.
So that was a trade-off, and I'll tell you about that. Anyhow, when I spoke to him, he said, Lewis, I'd like to help you out, but there's little or nothing here. I will hold up a final report, try to get the case settled. He said, other than some mild muscle spasm, there's nothing of a permanent nature to Mrs. D'Angelo. Those are killer words, because when there's no permanency, there's no case.
Exactly. Did the insurance company have a doctor?
Oh, they sure did. The defense doctor said that although Mrs. D'Angelo had some limitation of motion and consistent subjective complaints, she was exaggerating, and he found no objective basis to assess any permanent disability. In other words, he couldn't find anything that was tangible.
Exactly.
That an x-ray, something, mm-hmm. a scar.
Something that showed damage.
That, right, of a permanent nature. A fracture, you know.
Right.
So the party seeking the recovery had approved this permanent injury. And again, that was a trade-off. It used to be that any degree of contributory negligence in an accident, even if you were 1% at fault, barred you from claiming. That was an archaic, terrible law. Hmm. You couldn't collect if you were in an accident. They'd
course.
Always have some kind of, you contributed in some way.
Right.
You didn't
you
didn't break you fast
looking,
enough, whatever.
Exactly. Yeah.
So they changed that. They traded that off, and they said there had to be a permanent injury, but it could be comparative negligence. If you were 10% at fault, you would only collect 90% of the damages. That's how it worked out. If you were 50% at fault, you would collect 50% of your damages.
Makes sense.
So that's a much better way. But also, you had to show a permanent injury. And sometimes that's hard to do, and the juries are skeptical. They're sitting up there. It's not them. People are claiming money, and they don't want to give money for people that are not permanently injured. That's what the charge from the jury is, from the judge, from the bench.
Right.
Okay.
So what happened then?
Well, I get a call from the judge's clerk. Mm-hmm. You are number one for Monday. That means you're going to trial Monday morning.
Okay.
But we had no choice. So I met with Mrs. D'Angelo Sunday afternoon in my office. And we went over her testimony, and I prepared her for cross-examination. I explained to her that all she had to do was tell the truth, and that we had little or nothing to lose since the offer to settle was zero. I didn't tell her that I was shaking in my pants because I couldn't prove any permanency. My knees were knocking. You know, I got a lot at stake, not just a client, but we also
Your
have
reputation
a
reputation, too.
Sure, and a lot of money invested in the case.
Mm-hmm.
So on Monday morning, down to the courthouse, Ann and I went. And I was up against the wall. She was not happy, but we had no choice.
Yep.
The courthouse was the tallest building in town at the time. It was built of white granite in the 1920s in anticipation of the growth of Miami.
Mm-hmm.
It had large, wide sets of stairs in the front with Greek columns and marble floors.
Wow.
And I always think of the floors because they caused all kinds of clicking and clacking when the women in high heels walked on them. And the elevators had engraved bronze doors. On the top floor, there was a jail and the sheriff's office. And the floors below held courtrooms. And below those were clerks and the property tax office. Our trial was to be heard in the main courtroom, which was two stories high, paneled in dark wood, with elevated platforms for the judge, jury, and the witness stand. And there were about 20 rows of seats for the audience. And there were tall windows, and they were draped in heavy fabric. It was really an intimidating place. Mrs. D'Angelo was frightened, and frankly, so was I.
And what did she say at that moment?
Well, she said, "Mr. Ress, can't we settle? I don't want to testify." And there was Joe Stanton, this plaintiff's attorney, very sharp-looking guy in a beautifully tailored suit, standing next to his client, Mr. Wilson. And I went up to him. I said, "Joe, can I speak to you for a minute?" "Lewis, if you're talking about settlement, the answer is no, not a penny. I'm going to whip you in this case."
Oh.
He said that right in front of his client. And Mr. Wilson, the client, was smirking. It's looking at me as though I was nobody. So I was left with no alternative. I had no choice.
What'd you do?
Well, we put the jury on,
mm-hmm.
and we interviewed them. The judge came in, and we started the trial, and he brings in a panel of jurors. And we start questioning them. So he puts on, if we need six jurors, he'll put on like 20 people in the jury box area.
Okay.
And we start questioning them. And then after we question them, we exercise our challenges, which I'll tell you more about. You get like three challenges each for each person in the case, each party.
I see.
So we had three and they had three. And you can't use them for discriminatory purposes, for race or religion,
right.
Things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You can only use them if you feel some reason that the juror might be biased against you.
Okay.
Then we made our opening statements. And I was intentionally vague because I didn't know what was going to come from the witness stand. We might only have Mrs. D'Angelo's unsubstantiated subjective complaints to establish the permanent disability. This is going to be a case of a permanent disability.
And what is a subjective complaint?
That's when you say it hurts me, but there's no reason. Say I have a terrible headache.
I see.
How is anyone going to say that you don't have a headache?
Right.
But if they don't believe you, they say, "Oh, come on, that's nonsense. She doesn't have a headache."
Exactly.
So this is the client complaining of pain and limitation without any medical tangible backup, like an x-ray. So Mrs. D'Angelo testified about the accident and her injuries and her limitations. And then the defense attorney, Joe Stanton, realized that a tough cross-examination of her could backfire. So he was pretty gentle with her. He didn't bring out that the person driving Mr. Wilson's car could, by just turning his head to the right, he could see all the way up the road. where she was driving. In other words, he established that there was no blockage of the view, and that it was a clear view, and that Mr. Wilson could see her. And so to establish Mr. Wilson's testimony, that he looked up the road, he saw her, she was coming, he had plenty of time.
Right.
And she admitted that the view up the road was unobstructed.
And then what happened next?
Well, Dr. Ortiz had not shown up.
Uh-oh.
And that's not the first time I had a doctor not show up.
Great.
So I asked for a brief recess and called his office. And the secretary said, "Oh, Mr. S., Dr. Ortiz has been held up in emergency surgery, but he'll be there. Although he did mention to me that he didn't think you would really want him to testify." Oh, boy, was I in trouble. And these guys, particularly orthopedists and neurosurgeons, are very headstrong people. They didn't get there. They fought their way up.
Yes.
It's a rough battle to become a neurosurgeon or an orthopedist.
I bet, yeah.
Very competitive, very backbiting, very nasty business, and they are tough guys.
You need grit.
They don't give you an inch. If they don't want to, they don't give you an inch. So I was in trouble. I said, "If you are in touch with Dr. Ortiz, please tell him that I need him at the courtroom right away." In trouble. Boy, was I in trouble.
You were, yeah.
I was shaking. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what was going to happen. How do I handle this? What can I say to Dr. Ortiz to change his mind, to have him give me some permanency? Well, over Mr. Stanton's objection, the judge granted me leave to produce Dr. Ortiz out of turn, since he had been in the emergency room doing surgery.
And what does out of turn mean?
That means you can put on other witnesses and even allow the defense to start its case, and then stop the trial when the doctor shows up and insert him into the trial in an inappropriate place, but to accommodate him.
I see. Okay.
Well, Mr. Wilson took the stand for the defense. They were now starting their case. And he gave the same story as he did before, almost as though it was rehearsed. I'm sure it was rehearsed. And it was my turn to cross-examine him. I asked him some simple questions to get him talking. Sometimes you do that, you know, what's your name, wow, nice day, tell us where you came from, where you went to school, whatever, tell us about your family. Open questions without any specific answer in mind, just to get them to start loosening up.
I see.
And he did. And so then I got him into the story about how the accident happened. And I gradually positioned myself to his right. I walked to his right, slightly behind where he was sitting. Right behind his right shoulder. And I don't know what made me do this, but I don't like to stand still when I'm speaking in the courtroom. And now Mr. Wilson had me standing behind him with questions coming from his right side and the back of him.
So you were almost behind him there.
Right. Okay. And I said, "Mr. Wilson, why don't you face me when I ask you my questions?" And he says, "Mr. Ress, you know I have arthritis. And I got treated for it, and it was aggravated in the accident. I cannot turn my head to the right at all. I have to turn my entire body." I said, "Then you could never turn your head to the right once you got the arthritis?" He said, "That's
right.
You're
getting at."
He said, "I couldn't."
You got him. You got him.
Well, I thought to myself, I do have him. Stop there, Lewis. Don't belabor it. You got what you want. Don't give him the opportunity to explain it away. Because he would have said, "Well, I was fine before the accident,
exactly.
Now I'm bad."
You have to cut
so
it right
I
there.
Cut it right there. Because I had him saying he always had that problem. I said, "No further questions, Your Honor."
Good.
In walks Dr. Ortiz. He enters the rear room door of the courtroom, and he gives me a sheepish look.
Oh,
and
boy.
And then he looks down, and he held a small office file in his hand.
Oh, gosh.
Well, was I in trouble?
Uh-huh.
"Your Honor, may I have 3 minutes to talk to Dr. Ortiz before I put him on?" Granted. So now I get hold of Dr. Ortiz in the back of the courtroom. I said, Art, I'm desperate. Can't you help me even a little? Isn't there something my client can't do?" He said, "She can't have sex in the position of the lion." I said, "Take the stand." I didn't know what the hell he was talking about.
Oh, my goodness.
"Take the stand." So I qualified him, and he was a wonderful, you know, he went to that school and this school, and he had this residency and that fellowship, and he was in this society. Of course, he had testified for the other attorney, Joe Stanton, in the past. So Joe Stanton wasn't about to cross-examine him on his qualifications. He doesn't want to disqualify him because he's going to be calling him again as his witness in another case. So then Dr. Ortiz described the history and the treatment, and then came the key question.
What was it?
Dr. Ortiz, as a result of the injury sustained in this accident, is there any activity in which Mrs. DeAngelo is unable to engage?
And then what happened?
Well, boy, here it comes. Either I'm going to live or die. Neither I nor the jury had any idea of what having sex in the position of the lion was. Dr. Ortiz says, Mrs. DeAngelo cannot have sex in the position of the lion. For 30 minutes, this conservative orthopedist clearly and methodically described in great detail what having sex in the position of the lion was. The jury was leaning out over their seats in rapt attention. Mrs. DeAngelo, the skinny old maid, she was blushing there. And Joe Stanton, the other attorney, was in a state of shock. Dr. Ortiz made eye contact with each of the jurors. He spoke distinctly and without any accent. He said, the woman gets on all fours, that is, on her hands and knees. The man mounts her from behind, that is, from the rear. There are certain nerves involved that enhance the pleasure of penetration from this position.
Oh, goodness.
But in Mrs. DeAngelo's case, it would cause her exquisite pain. There's a skinny old man sitting there. The jurors listened. They're all leaning over. He went on. He said, yes, Mr. Ress, the pain to Mrs. DeAngelo would be exquisite. And he went into detail. And
what did the other attorney do at the sound of all this?
He was plotting. He had a problem. He had a dilemma. He couldn't do anything. He couldn't think of any questions to ask Dr. Ortiz without making the situation worse.
He was stomped, completely stomped.
So then we go to closing argument, and I went to town. I jumped on Mr. Wilson's inconsistent sworn testimony, and I said, you know, how could he have looked up and down that street when he can't turn his head to the right? He has to turn his whole body. He tried to mislead us. He lied to us. He lied to us under oath.
Yes.
Then I stressed Mrs. DeAngelo's future pain. We all heard Dr. Ortiz, a respected orthopedic specialist, describe the lengthy treatment and the pain experience suffered by Mrs. DeAngelo and her future of exquisite pain caused by this injury.
Was the trial over at that point?
Yep. The case was over, and we waited for the jury to come back with a verdict. No matter how experienced you are, it's a crazy, stressful time with no one knowing what the outcome will be. I couldn't believe that Dr. Ortiz came up with that wild testimony.
Yeah.
My client had blushed and had been clearly embarrassed by it, but the jury paid rapt attention. They were envisaging the position of the lion with my meek client being the sex object.
Goodness.
And after 3 hours, the judge's clerk called out, Mr. Rez, come into the courtroom. The jury has reached a verdict. We, the jury, find for the plaintiff and award damages in the amount of $50,000. So say we all.
What a story. Well, you won that one.
Yeah.
So what's the lesson here? We always get a lesson from your stories.
Yeah, and all of these stories is a moral lesson. Number one, never say never.
You never know, yeah. It's
you
true.
Never know. Don't be arrogant. Things can suddenly change. Joe Stanton lived to regret that that decision of being, arrogant. Mm-hmm. And they should have, like all cases, they should have settled it. But then you never know what's coming.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to, they used to say in college, expect the unexpected. How can you anticipate something like that? What you have to do is, when something like that happens, you have to be able to flex and not get caught flat-footed and extemporize. So you never know. You have to be able to adjust. What he should have immediately done is adjust his case and said, hold it. But my client couldn't turn because of the injuries in this accident. And he had this... And the client put the client back on the stand and say, oh, no, you got it wrong. Mm. I could turn then, but I can't turn now.
Yeah.
And it's all because of her.
Right.
That was the first thing he didn't do. The second thing was he should have gone after Mrs. DeAngelo and said, do you have sex in the position of the lion? Do you anticipate having sex?
Why do you think he just gave up? He was just like,
he was afraid.
He couldn't think straight.
What was she going to say? She's this timid lady. He had nothing to lose. She said, "Oh yeah, I have sex all the time. You're not married, ma'am."
Right.
There's a lot of women on the jury that don't like the fact that a woman has sex and is not married. Maybe there's a moralist on there. You never know. So you gotta have your wits to take a shot back.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes,
at least try.
I hate to ask a question where I don't know the answer, but there are sometimes you have to take a chance. So, and also, you find out that, like Dr. Ortiz, what happened? You know, for the doctor to come up with that stuff is crazy. He wanted to have some fun. He did it intentionally or subconsciously, but he was giving us the business. He says, "You want permanency? I'll give it
to
you." And also,
Be sure.
The jury wants to be entertained.
That's true.
This becomes a psychodrama.
Right.
And everyone plays a part. The judge plays the part. The lawyers play a part. The witnesses play a part. The parties play a part. And the jury plays a part. And we're all involved. It's like a theater.
Yeah.
And we're all
it's a show.
In a theatrical setting. The courtroom is just like a theater. In fact, a lot of theater shows courtrooms as part of the scene and the cases, or the theater is about the courtroom.
It's a performance, really.
Yeah, it's an entertainment. It really is an entertainment. So, I think it was funny because everyone was in a state of shock, and I was too. And I didn't want to belabor it. I wanted to leave the picture to the jury's imagination. Sometimes what is unsaid is stronger than if you get into it and tear it apart and shred it. So
just wanted to leave it as it is.
If you're trying a case, if you're a good lawyer, you just want to leave it to the jury's imagination. Let they visualize this woman on her hands and knees having sex.
Oh boy,
I thought it was pretty wild. So asking questions where you don't know the answer is generally a big, big mistake. You can get slammed. It's hard to predict the outcome of a jury case. I find that judges, non-jury cases, tend to award favorably to the plaintiff. In a jury case, it's about 50-50. The defense wins about half the time. It's a very dangerous thing to try a case in front of a jury.
Right. It can go either way. Yeah.
Especially the defense doesn't go in front of a jury unless they have some reason to. And when they do that, it's a warning to you that something's coming up, coming at you that you may not be prepared for.
Right.
Sometimes cases settle while the jury is out. You try the whole case, the jury's out, and the plaintiff, mostly the client, says, "I don't want to take a chance. I can't take a chance of losing this case. I've got costs, maybe $40,000 worth of doctor's testimony and depositions and transcripts and travel expenses and so on. I've got to get this case settled." And so while the jury's out, the two attorneys get together and get the clients in and get the case settled. That happens frequently. Some lawyers want to keep trying for the big verdict. And they're looking for the pot of gold. And they know that if they try 100 cases, maybe one of them will come back with an untoward verdict. And they don't care about the clients. They care about themselves and the glory of having a famous case, big verdict, and the possibility of that happening. So they figure out, they add up all the cases, win, lose, and they make an economic projection for themselves, not for the client.
Yeah.
And that, to me, I think is unethical. So those are some of the, you know, I tell you a little bit about the verdicts also. Who constitutes a jury? Under the United States Constitution, Article 3 and the Sixth Amendment also, you're entitled to an impartial jury and of your peers. Well, what does that mean?
Right.
Nobody knows. What's a jury of your peers? Impartial. Impartial means that you can ask questions, and if they're prejudiced against you, you can challenge them off. Peers means generally countrymen. It doesn't mean economic, social, racial, intellectual peers. It doesn't mean people of your equal.
Yeah.
It means people who have the equal citizenship with you.
Do you see that changing at all? No, right?
No.
Not likely.
No, I don't think that'll ever change. I don't think that'll ever change.
That's interesting.
You have to have a unanimous decision also. It used to be some states like Louisiana, for example, or Oregon, they used to have a majority.
Mm-hmm. So now it has to be, everyone has to agree.
Yeah, now it has to be unanimous. There's a federal case on that point.
Hmm.
And it
From
applies
when?
To state trials too.
Was it recent or? It's,
yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I don't remember the case, but I do remember that it came up before the United States Supreme Court, and I do remember that not too long ago, they require a unanimous decision, particularly in criminal cases.
Criminal cases,
but
yeah.
in all of them,
mm-hmm.
and you don't get a jury trial in every single case, even though the Constitution says you do. The Supreme Court said, well, we can't do that and provide a counsel for the defendant in criminal cases. Suppose it's a drunk driving case or a traffic case. You're not going to get an attorney assigned to you, and you're not going to get a jury trial. You're going to go in front of a magistrate or a sheriff's judge. Justice of the peace, that sort of stuff. And you're not going to get a jury trial. Some of them, for example, if you have a drunk driving case, you would think that with a penalty of possible incarceration, that you would get entitled to a jury trial, but you're not. So they draw the lines. Where they draw the lines, interesting. But they do draw the line.
But so like cases of homicide or something.
Homicide's
no.
different.
So,
That's
but
not
drunk
a misdemeanor
driving specifically.
Or a petty offense.
Huh.
They consider drunk driving to be a petty offense rather than.
Wow. Okay.
But it's a felony.
Yeah.
But you don't get a jury trial.
Huh.
So that's where they drew the line. Okay. Does that answer your?
Oh yeah.
Your question.
Quite a bit here. Thank you. Thanks, Liz.
Thank you, and I can tell you something else. After the case, and I gave Mrs. D'Angelo her check. I never heard from her again.
She probably couldn't look you straight in the eye after that.
She took the money and disappeared. We never had a discussion or said anything about the position of
Didn't
the
talk
lion.
About it.
Well, I thought maybe she was going to offer to experiment with me.
Maybe she went, yeah. She definitely tried it when
I'm
she left.
I'm a happily married man, and I can tell you, I've never experienced the position of the lion either.
Oh, goodness. How funny. Thank you, Lewis. This is a great story. Thanks. Until next time.